They brought up the demands, presented to the union, they were endorsed, and this is what they want from the company. And of course, they select the committee to go up to present to the Connor. He has a big store there, what you call a general store. And his office is in the back of the store. And we went there, asked for him, and they said he's back in the office. Went back and rapped on the door, and he came to the door himself. And I said, Mr. Connor, I says, we've came here. We had already sent a letter in which we claimed the majority of his workers. According to law, we asked for representation recognition. Well, when I presented, I didn't get this more than out of my mouth. He didn't let us come in. But that guy, he's a big tall guy, he jumped straight up in the air. I'll be goddamned. He says, if I will ever recognize a union, I never have and I never will, and get out of here. I said, oh yes, Mr. Connor, you're going to recognize this union before it's over. Well, he was shutting the door at that time. That was the last conversation that I had a chance to have with him. And anyhow, then of course, we called the labor board for a labor board election, won the majority, and he at the same time set up a company union and got the Wisconsin labor board in there with a minority, and they certified him as the collective bargaining agent. And of course, on top of that, this company union, he went to Green Bay, Wisconsin, got a hold of the Carpenters Union, and to give them a charter. And this union that they had, the superintendent of the plant was president of the union. All the bosses held the union positions. And of course, then he put bulletins on the board. As of a certain day, all employees, he signed a closed shop agreement with this union. As of a certain day, all employees must be members of this union, otherwise they cannot work there any longer. Of course, we said, yes, we're going to work there, and we're not going to join the company union, but instead, on that very day, we're going to close these plant down. So we took our union members, we had a meeting, they went back into the shop, onto their regular jobs, and nobody joined up with his company union. So at 9 o'clock, the company began to move, taking all the bosses and the superintendent and sending them out through the shops to go to the workers with their cards to sign them up. And of course, that was a signal to clean out the shop. So it seemed that our workers had pretty well bunched in the back end of the shop. Didn't want to miss anybody there or be missed. So that was a signal when they attempted to make them join the union to close the shop. And when they come out of the shop, they didn't only come out, but they brought the company union with them, bosses and all. They were ahead of them. And the picket line was put up and the fight was on. Well, that was quite a long drawn out strike in which the company used every method possible. They drove tractors through the picket lines. They done everything, but they were unable. They did get some workers in. On some days, and the next day they couldn't get anybody, and then it went seesawed back and forth. So Conrad had this experience of how to really beat them, and that is get the vigilantes. He was the head of the vigilantes throughout that part of the country up there. I mean, he's the guy that hired them. And of course, naturally, was assisted by a lot of other employers, because before he had a reputation of just breaking everything. Well, so they call on the vigilantes, and they begin to use the methods of arresting. I myself, naturally, they figured, well, if you behead a thing, then it'll die anyhow. So they figured, well, I was the guy. So they arrested me 7 times in 5 days, just as fast as I could get out. In fact, they wouldn't even let me go over across the street and get a decent piece of pie to eat. But the people, as I said before, were on the side of the workers, not on the side of Connor. None of them. I couldn't find a farmer up there, such as the farmers were, you know, that was on their side. Businessmen. He oppressed them. He made them live under his thumb if they wanted to do any kind of business. And all of this, he ruled about three counties there, just absolutely ruled them. If anybody put any opposition, when they had election, find out the arrests didn't do it. And so we had the picket line out one morning, and what came down on there but a whole gang of these vigilantes that they had used the year before up in Michigan. We found out afterwards they weren't from around there, although the main leader lived in this town, Kenny somebody, who afterwards, Connor, they caught him after Connor had been, or after Henry Paul, the attorney, and the president had been caught up there and kidnapped and beat up. Then this Kenny, whatever it was, they put him out of sight someplace, you see. But while our strike was going on, he was picked up in Milwaukee by a policeman who probably was a good policeman, I mean. But anyhow, that's the guy. You see, there was a warrant out for him. Mm-hmm. Henry Paul had a warrant out for him. They caught him. It was settled out of court, and I understand from Henry Paul, told me, that they paid. I was thinking it's going to be a very interesting court fight, you know, because it'll bring up the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, they paid him $20,000. Mm-hmm. And that freed the guy, you see. And I'll be damned if Fury ain't back leading this one. But here is where you really seen workers fight. They came down with very nice, good axe handles, pick handle, hack handles and all this. This was the clubs of the vigilantes. The workers had nothing, whatever. Nothing. But anyhow, there was a good fight took place. They just didn't give up without any. And they decided, well, if they're going to fight that way, we're going to fight. So happened that I was in jail while this was going on, showing you that workers can get along without the one that's supposed to be the leader. Company many times think if you organize collectively,
mm-hmm.
because they knew how to carry on. So they went back, and there was tamarack swamps, and there was rock piles, and they had special details out there cutting their cells out some nice clubs. Of course, after they chased the workers away, then the vigilantes, they parade. And they got the picket line. They're going to open it up. But when that charge took place from the workers out of those tamarack swamps, those vigilantes went. Boy, and believe me, they went. For 3 days. It reminds me of some of the stories my dad used to tell about the old Civil War battles. I mean, how they fought back and forth. They had a thing one day, and the other side had it the next day. For 3 days, that's the way it went back and forth. Well, the workers can only fight as long as they had ammunition, you see. And, of course, when they run out of ammunition, they retreat back into the swamp. But believe me, those vigilantes never came into the swamp. Never did. Well, then, of course, then they had called off the vigilantes for a while. See, because this was bringing in people not only from right around there, but they was bringing in from miles. The newspaper reporters was up from Milwaukee and Madison and all these places, and it began to be a statewide, at least, issue. Well, then, of course, it went along. He demanded another election. Okay, we have another. We demanded that the State Labor Board come up there, and they came up there, and we had a hearing. Explained what kind of an organization they were collaborating with the company and with the AFL in doing this, you see. But we, right there on the spot, they decertified Connor's company union right there in the courthouse. In fact, the State Labor Board was in a pretty tough spot the time we got done with them for certifying such an organization. Well, then by that time, the workers, they seen that this union knew how to do something. In fact, the workers over there, not only one, but we had 300 people or more, that is with the families and things like that, who lived out of the strike headquarters. We had details of people, of women, who baked bread by the dozens of loaves. And we had farmers bringing in wagon loads of potatoes and cabbage and carrots, all kinds of vegetables. Bring in whole beef down there to the strike headquarters, people we never heard of. Well, we had a call out over the country, of course, for all kinds of support. We had a big room in the back as big as this. And I'll swear that was stacked up with food. And by golly, the worker said, "Why, hell, we can fight this as long as Connor wants to fight. We're eating more now than we ever ate all the time we worked for Connor over there." People that couldn't bring their children there came there and got their supplies. That was a storehouse. And it was really the best, in fact, the best supplied place that I ever seen. Well, if we run a little short on meat or pork, and of course, workers sometimes, they have to violate the law a little bit. I mean, they can't starve in a country that's full of deer. So sometimes maybe we didn't have a big quarter of beef to cook up because we're going to feed 200 or 300 people. It takes a lot. So we have a detail that goes out and just picks out a nice deer and brings them in. And they cook great big stews, that great big wash tubs. I mean, that's the way food was cooked up there. And those, as I said, that couldn't come over there and get their supplies, it was taken over to them. And they have more clothes than they ever had while they worked for Connor. Now, this is while they're on strike. They actually began to get dressed up. Get dressed up and their bellies were full. So, Connor then, of course, he began to figure, well, no. So, in one last effort, he decided, well, we're really going to bust it. I mean, you could tell it was an act of desperation. They got the hand-picked sheriffs to deputize, well, just anybody to get a hold of, people that was never known or seen up there before. Where they come from, nobody knows. But they went out and they barricaded all the roads. What they're getting ready for is to really come in. I don't know, maybe annihilate the strikers for the things and the preparations that they've done. Nobody knows. Because they chopped big trees down across the road. So nobody, you know, these supplies were coming in. So nobody could get in and nobody could get out. And in each one of these places, there they had a group. And every car that went through was searched. Everybody, they had to be assured of their business. Otherwise, they were turned back. That meant every road. And, of course, the word came that now this is the time they're going to do it, see. Well, Connor made a statement, or a lot of these made statements, some of the awfulest statements. They just said they're going to do it. That's all. They're really going to bust this whole thing and chase them out of town. It was in the Milwaukee Journal. It was in all the papers. Well, that night of the meeting, of course, we issued a statement right back, too. It was awful hard for us to get news, believe it or not. Even the telegraph agency held up the telegram, who didn't dare to send one out of town. The railroad company didn't dare to send one out of town. The posters, well, he had the post office there. They knew we couldn't get a piece of mail in there. It was really tied up, plus all the roads blocked out here. But anyhow, I got a statement through. You bet you we're going to get out of here. Of course, in the meeting, we had a big mass meeting, the biggest one of the whole strike. They were just jammed in the strike headquarters. They were jammed all around outside. Farmers, families, everybody was there. Connor was going to bust us, and here I was speaking and say, no, he's not going to bust us. He's only getting desperate now. Now he's getting to the point that he's actually whipped. He's going to help us to whip him with the very tactics he's using. Of course, I says, on top of this, we're going to the National Labor Relations Board. We couldn't get a letter through for them, but personally, we're going with a committee. Of course, they come by. They are not a statement in the paper. They won't go any place. They can't get out of here. How are they going to go to the National Labor Relations Board? But anyhow, here's a whole room full of reporters there. And I says, I made the statement there, workers. I says, you can rest assured that I will get to Washington, D.C., one way or the other. We can't get mail there. I'll get there personally. And I know John L. Lewis personally. And we're in his organization. And I knew, well, John, you know, when he gets mad, he was a pretty good guy. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was playing a good role. Well, anyhow, this statement broke in the paper, the photographers taking all of our pictures. This is quite personal, but I just want to show you what they will do. But in the meantime, workers always find ways and means of doing certain things. Well, they had every public road blocked. When the meeting was adjourned at night, it must have been about midnight. After the committee meetings, it must have been about 2 o'clock before everything was over. We got out of there. Of course, they didn't dare remember to come very close to strike headquarters. They want to catch you when you're way out someplace. I mean, you can't just bring this whole army out there like that. But you know what happened? I traveled through fire lanes. I mean, the forest rangers was forest. Usually, I mean, they're public hired people. But before that, I mean, before Connor had done all these things, they just didn't pay much attention. But after he'd done all of these things, vigilantes and all, everybody was against us. Conservatives and everybody else. I mean, was forest. They escorted us through fire lanes. Believe me, that old car never got such a bumping in its life. It was daylight in the morning and after, before we got out onto a public highway. Just from one fire lane and across the road and into another one, and we had escorts who knew the way through. And they took us through. And we got out, I wish I could remember the name of this county seat. And, of course, we're pretty hungry. I hadn't had anything to eat since supper. And the other fellow, it happened that there wasn't a big committee. There was just two of us, you see. Johnny Perninskis, his name was. He was killed during the war, in France, I think. But anyhow, Johnny and I was together. And we decided when we got into this town, well, we'll stop here and we'll get something to eat. So we stopped in a hotel. Just lucky we put our car around the back. We didn't want our car to be seen as we could, you see, because we had an idea that they had the license number and everything like that. And while we was waiting to get served, boy, oh boy, here come rattling past the door out there, trucks. And who were they? Loaded with strikers from the same place we'd left. From Leona. Loaded with strikers, putting them in this jail. Way down here, another county, way below that. They filled 3 county jails. I mean, the vigilantes then, they reorganized with all the deputies, and they came in there, and they just arrested everybody that they could possibly get a hold of. So happened that Jenny thought there was something like that coming. Somebody got the word to her, you know. Regardless of what they try to organize, you can always... Yeah. You can always find out what's going on. And so she, the night before, went way roundabout road, some real guy that lived in that territory knew about, and got the typewriters and mimeograph machines and everything and took it over to Rhinelander and rented a room and put all this stuff in there. You see? And she went back and they didn't arrest her. And then I said to Johnny, look at there. I said, boy, let's get out of here. But I knew, you know, that there's something up. So we left there and we drove clear down to Plymouth, Wisconsin. No breakfast. In fact, our order was in. We just left and never waited for the order to come at all. Never got a bite to eat. And we beat it down to Plymouth. We wanted to get as far away as we could, you know. We get into Plymouth and ordered our meal there. And it so happened we got a paper. We wanted to see what was going on. We got the paper, started to read it, and what do you think? There's my picture in it, speaking to the meeting. Well, that was all right. But another guy come in and sit down at the table, and he was facing us. And this sounds sort of funny, you know. He was facing us. I'm sure he wasn't looking for us at that time. But he had a paper. And I could watch him, he'd look at the paper and he'd look at me. I was facing him, he'd look at the paper and he'd look at me. I said, Johnny, come on. He got up and went to the telephone. Well, he got up and went to the telephone. I said, Johnny, come on, missed our breakfast again. So we run out and we got into the car. You know, it takes a certain length of time for them to telephone over and get ready to go out on their manhunt, so-called. Well, in there it said that there was a bench warrant out for him, anyhow. Well, we didn't know exactly what to do, and we thought real quick. Now, what are they going to do? We get in the car, we start down the highway, and we go real fast. They're going down that highway after us. Backtrack ourselves. Turn, go on a side road, and right back. And you know where we went? Right back within sight of the courthouse. Just on the opposite side, and we watched these guys going out. After they was gone, boy, they went down the highway to beat the band. So then we cut right out. We thought we can find some farm roads out in here that will run back away from the main highway. We were on one of the real main highways. So we followed farm roads, and we finally got around till we got clear into Milwaukee, and we got to the CIO headquarters. That was one of the main things, was to get in there. We got into the state CIO headquarters. Of course, they were waiting for us. The statement was in the paper that we had got out and that we were on our way. The reporters were up there, you know. They couldn't find us, and it was already reported that we were out. Well, we got in there, and of course, the CIO had very good leadership. And we told them exactly, besides they'd been reading the papers, and they had the whole leadership, statewide leadership, was all there that morning, or afternoon, rather. So it happened that we had one very good guy in a very strategic position, Emil Costello, who was a member of the state legislature, and a guy that wasn't afraid to tell Phil LaFalla just exactly what kind of a guy he was. So after hearing the story, and well, now what do we want to do? Well, I said, the first thing we want done up there is we want the vigilantes demobilized and called off, and we want the people that are arrested released, and the strike headquarters given back to us. Those are the first things we want. Oh, that'll be all right. I'll take care of it. Emil gets on the phone. Of course, the governor, naturally, had heard about this as well as everybody else was taking. Gets on the phone, calls over there. And I'll never forget, the name of the girl was Virginia. That was the secretary. I don't know what her nickname was, but her name was Virginia. Phil LaFollette's secretary. And of course, she didn't even have to ask him who it was. Emil spoke just like this, and I'm going to quote what he says. Virginia, he says, where is that damn faker this morning? Just like that over the telephone. Well, Virginia says, I don't know. She didn't even have to ask who Emil meant when he said the damn faker. You know. Didn't know. Well, she tried to make some alibis that he hadn't been feeling good or this and that. And so, okay, thanks. He hung up. I got another guy. He says, I'll call his stooge over there. And it so happens that his name was Rabbits. So he calls over there and he says the same thing, whatever his first was, but I know his last name was Rabbits. He says, where is that, and he didn't just say faker that time, he added a little more, what they may say, man language, got a little rougher, wanted to know, well, Emil, and he was trying to talk, and of course Emil was having us listen in the receiver with him. Well, my gosh, I don't know, if you don't know, how should I know? And, now, don't give me any of that stuff. He says, you're his stooge and you know every move that he makes. By the way, this guy is the secretary of the Wisconsin State Industrial Commission. Rabbits, that was his name. Well, he says, I'll tell you. He says, I haven't got time anymore. He says, you know what's going on in Leona. That's our organization up there. He says, the papers is full of it. I mean, he tried to make believe he didn't know all about it. He says, oh, yes, you do. That stuff that's in the paper is exactly what it is. And he says, that's the reason that faker is hiding today. Because he knows. Because we stated in my talk that one of our demands is that he do as they had done here in the state of Minnesota, and I showed him about the struck wire and so on and so forth, where the governor had called out the National Guards to protect against any of the violence like these vigilantes was. And this was a demand going to be placed on Governor LaFollette. Well, he says, I'll tell you what I want. I'm going to give you the message. I can't get a hold of him. He says, unless 10 minutes that I get a call back here that the vigilantes has been demobilized, that those workers have been released from jail, taken back to Leona, and the strike headquarters has been given back into the possession of strikers, he says, I'm leaving here with the ball bat crew. Well, now, that's a historical ball bat crew. That was the crew that won the Nash strike a year or so before that, in which, when they brought in the National Guard to protect the scabs and used violence against the workers, the union there bought out every dime store that there was around there of their ball bats. And they went down there and they marched on them, and they penned in not only the scabs who was inside, but they chased the National Guards back inside of the Nash plant, and they had to beg to let them out. The workers were going to starve to death. So the ball bat crew had a very good reputation in the state of Wisconsin. He says, "I'll start out." Of course, he exaggerated a little bit. He says, "I can get 100 cars here in 10 minutes, and you know it." And he says, "When we get up there, if the governor can't establish law and order and civil rights, we will establish it, I'll guarantee you, when we get up there." And he's a member of the state legislature, speaking this way. Well, anyhow, okay, I'll see what I can do. Well, Amel says, "Now, fellas, just wait a minute. I'll make you a bet." And he laid his watch on the table. He says, "I'll bet you it ain't 10. Well, first, rabbits had begged for more time. He wanted 20 minutes. And Amel says, "Not by that damn sight. Those workers are suffering up there. 10 minutes is important." But anyhow, they compromised on 15 minutes. He said, "All right, I'll give you 15 minutes before I put out the call for the ball bat crew." And he laid his watch on the table. It was very interesting to see how things work out. He says, "I'll bet you that it ain't 10 minutes, and he'll call back." And we were listening in the phone. I mean, the phone rang in less than 10 minutes. It was just 8 minutes. Rabbits was on the phone, not La Follette. And he says, "Well," he says, "I got in touch with the governor, and I will read the," I guess he called a proclamation. Anyhow, it was to all the sheriffs up there, to disband the vigilantes, arrest them, release all these people from jail, see that the strike headquarters is turned back into the hands of the workers. And he says, "Amel, it's already being done." He says, "How's that?" Well, he says, "That's some guy you got there as governor on." But anyhow, that was the way it worked, and it was. It was all of these things were reestablished. Well, I got to Washington. All during the day, after it had come out in the paper that we had got out through the barricades, as they called them, the reporters kept constantly calling into the CIO office, because I told them that I was going to get there. I mean, I made that statement. And all day long they was calling. And finally, they told me, mentioned a fellow's name who was calling there. By the way, on the Milwaukee Journal, they had the same reporter who was considered in Milwaukee at this time, quite a reactionary young fellow, but nevertheless, he was the only one who gave a statement while he was here in Minneapolis for the Tribune, a factual statement that the union gave him of the Flower City strike. So I just had a little confidence, and through this, we had become quite friendly. Well, I asked Amel, "What do you think if I talk to him?" "Oh my God, don't." He says, "He'll turn you in right away." Well, I just, in a funny way, I said, "I don't think he will, Amel." And I told him, "No." Well, he says, "If you want to talk to him, all well and good." So he called up, and I did. He says, "Yeah." He says, "Is he here?" He says, "Can you keep your mouth shut?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "He's here right now." Got on the phone, got a swell greeting, and I told him, "Now, understand," I says, you got the scoop on it. He thought he had a scoop, all right. But I said, "Will you do me a favor?" Of course, I was leaving this in the afternoon. I said, "Don't put it until the late edition. Then you can that you was in contact with me. By that time, I'll be over in the state of Illinois," you see. And they didn't have a bench warrant for me in the state of Illinois. So as soon as I gave him the statement, we jumped in the car and went over in the state of Illinois. And then, of course, there I left the car and went by myself from there on in, get to see John L. Lewis and the National Labor Relations Board. Well, this was a long thing, but there's one other thing I want to say, because it never happened to, that I know of, any place else in the country. I got into the CIO office the next morning. I was there just a little after it opened up, I guess. And as I said, I knew John L. Lewis from the days that I lived in West Virginia. I had spoke on the platform with him on two or three occasions. You see, in where I lived, Clarksburg, West Virginia, was a place for a number of years. Every Labor Day, John L. Lewis spoke there. Mother Jones spoke there. All of these leaders used to speak there, especially the coal mine leaders. And so I got in there, and the girl, and she asked me what I wanted to see or what I wanted, and I told her, and she gave her the name, of course, and she went in there. Why, he says, send him in right away. So I walked in there, and this is funny, Maridel, you know. He looked at me just like this. Well, for Christ's sake, he says, he drew a long, drawn-out voice, you know. That is Mayville, sure enough. He got up, he shook hands with me, and he says, you know, he says, I've often thought, what it would become of you. You know, I used to fight against him. I was out leading these wildcat strikes when he was trying to make the workers go back to work. In fact, I had him one time after I'd been out helping the workers, and on these wildcat strikes happened to be right there in the town I lived in, Clarksburg, where on late Labor Day, I was elected by the Labor Assembly there to as their speaker, you see, on the platform. Mother Jones was there, and I was supposed to speak representing the local labor movement. He refused, when he found out I was on the program, the name was on there, you know, he refused to speak on the same platform with me. And they had to have a little conference, and the outcome of the conference was, after all, it's under the auspices of the local labor movement. So the word back to John L. was, well, you either speak on the same platform with him or you don't speak here at all. But he spoke anyhow, but he was mad, you know, he still was mad at me, but he greeted me very nice that day. Told him what I wanted. He said, okay. He says, I'll see that you get there. He called up the National Labor Relations Board, the chairman, Madden, just composed of Madden and two Smiths at that time. Of course, it's very unusual, you know, for somebody to come directly there and request that you appear before them. Well, there was one thing I skipped over, and that was after we had kicked out the State Labor Board, their decision in there, what happened? The representative of the National Labor Relations Board in Milwaukee done the same thing and certified the same company union, you see, which was making our struggle more tough. And what I wanted to see them about was they had the certification. And we had won the election. And this is what I wanted to see him about. So when I told John L. Lewis, and of course he repeated to them exactly what it was, he says, that ain't the way business is run. He says, you see this fellow. He says, I know him. He says, I have known him for years. That's what John L. Lewis said to him. Well, I went up, and that was at about 11 o'clock. We went right in before the board. All three of them was there. I told them my story. I forget what the name of the guy is. He's now a labor relations man for Sears and Roebuck in Chicago, the last guy that I heard, because he was fired. That was his last act, certifying that company union in Leona. Well, if they said at that time, of course, I don't know if this guy just rushed there or not, but anyhow, he took a vacation right after he heard that I was going there. He took a vacation, and he said, well, he says, this is kind of lucky. He says, he's right here in town today, in Washington. He says, how about, he says, getting him here, and you, of course, I did have the attorney, you know, a funny situation. We had three Smiths, two labor board Smiths, and the CIO attorney's name was Smith. And he says, how about 2 o'clock this afternoon, and we'll have him here. Sure enough, they called him, they had him up there. He says, now I told him the whole story, what had went on, as I'm reciting here, practically. And, then when that afternoon, when I come in and they all got, he says, now I want you to go over the same ground that you did this morning that we heard. And I did. Same thing. That guy was sitting over there in the corner, and asked him, well, what have you got to say about it? Now we've heard Mr. Mayville's side over here. Well, he says, that's all that's to be said. He says, that's the way it was. And he says, and you mean you certified that union? Well, he says, I guess I did. That's what he said, just like that. Calm as a little boy. Well, he says, you decertify it right away. That's it. Okay. As soon as this is over, you send a telegram up there to Connor and to everybody else that needs to be that's decertified. See? Of course, it might cost another. And of course, he wants to know, well, now what went on. And we sit down. We told him. You know, he's snappy and funny. He catches every little point. He's shrewd. So we got to the point that where we made him admit that he certified a company union. John Lewis says, and Jesus Christ, he says, you didn't demand they fire him right there? What is the matter with you, you dumbbells? He He's just bawling everybody out, you know. But anyhow, that's the way that ended. But except, he says, well, he says, I suppose you need a little money up there, don't you? In fact, I was going. I says, yes, and certainly the workers in that situation can use some money. Called the secretary out there, he says, make out a check here. He wanted to know what the local was, so on and so forth. $500. I carried it back to Leon. Well, now, there was, it shows how workers will fight in any place. Main thing is, regardless of how backward you may have thought they were, they'll fight. Well, there's one little further thing I want to say about that. What kind of a place is Leona now? After all these years of living, as we called it in our paper, we had a little paper that we put it out every day. We called it the Leona Liberator. In the labor board hearings, Connery brought in some of these papers. Liberator of hell! Who are they trying to liberate? But anyhow, that was the name of the paper. And finally, after the other election, we had to go through another election. And that other election was so overwhelming. I mean, by God, I'm quite sure that even some of the bosses even voted for us. They must have. The workers figured out up there. And there must have even been some of the bosses that voted for the union, for the CIO. So they, had to have a labor board hearing. There was a lot of things took place. I mean, they had an election there in which Connor run it in the same old method. And in which he looked at the ballots, and all these things were brought into the labor board hearing. And you know, right, it had gone on. This labor board hearing went on for weeks. And finally, practically out of the sky, or out of the blue sky, Connor broke down. The guy that you could never whip broke down and even cried. And he said, I give in. He said, I give in. And he says, I'm ready to negotiate an agreement. He negotiated the agreement, the best one that they had any place in the state. And I was talking with the international representative here a while back. And this is kind of personal, but anyhow, I was brought back here to the state of Minnesota then. I mean, before all of this was over. And he told this whatever his name was again, can't think of names very good, but he told him, or asked him, he says, if you ever see Mayville, he says, will you tell him if he can ever get up into this country to come and see me? And he says, he went on further, he says, do you know that that's a funny guy? I'd like to see what the hell he's made of. He says, we done everything we could, and it didn't make a damn bit of difference. He says, jail didn't affect him. Nothing affected him. He just was that determined. He says, I'd just like to see a guy like that. I never thought in the world that there was a guy that could whip me. Of course, he gave it credit. He says, and he's the only one could. You see, he doesn't understand workers. All I done in that case, again, was help to give leadership. And of course, along with this, you've got to be determined. You've got to be able to withstand whatever they may do, otherwise you're just no good. If they can throw you in jail and by that break you down, they'll break the whole union. Tell you why I think. For my own self, I've always tried to conduct myself, especially in struggles, in a way that would get this confidence. You've got to have that or you can't do anything. And it just don't come about just overnight. It's mainly by example. But if you participate in leadership and give advice and leadership, that brings about results. You see, this is what builds the confidence. I always had it because it goes clear back to my dad, and he put it in a very funny way. He never studied Marxism, which I have done some, to quite an extent. But he was a practical thinker. He was quite a man of the world. I mean by that, he traveled extensively. He was what he called an itchy foot type of a guy. He put in 14 years on the saltwater sailing, and he would be back and he would blow glass for a while. And sometimes when he wanted to get away from it all, he would go out and trap a winter. And things of this kind. Of course, he was quite, I mean, he wasn't married until quite late in life, had a broad experience. Went through the Civil War from very beginning to end. Before he come home on a furlough, I mean, if you enlist right away, that should give you a furlough before you're going in your next hitch. So he enlisted the very first call by Lincoln. It's 3 months, that was only for 3 months. Lincoln thought in 3 months he'd have it all over with, you'll remember. And of course it wasn't even started. In fact, they were getting a pretty bad battering at that time. Then the next call was for 3 years. And of course, then 3 years was over, it still wasn't one, but the last call was again for only 3 months. It was mainly a matter of wiping up. But he had a sort of a way of thinking that and he told us this when we was kids practically, maybe so little that maybe some kids wouldn't understand it, maybe we didn't understand it right in the first, that you belong to a class. You belong to a class who do all the work. Now, this is the language you'd put it in. We, the working people and the farmers, we carry the whole thing. On top of us sets, he used to have the word parasite. Now, wherever that came from. On top of us sets all these parasites. And he would point out, I mean. And he would show us by concrete examples. There was mill owners there and how they lived and the money they had. And they never went out, and they never pulled a saw, and they never swung an axe, you see. Their business was to set and figure how in the hell they can take away from other people what they made and what they produced. Well, that's quite Marxist, you know. Mm-hmm. For a man, I'm quite sure, because I don't think he ever mentioned it. Now, and then he went on with another thing, and that was, after putting in all this time, very patriotic man. A great man for the GAR, you know, that was the old veterans organization. Mm-hmm. But an opposition, I can remember when he used to lead me by the hand and we used to go to the Republican caucuses. He was a Republican all his life, but he always wanted to distinguish what kind of a Republican he was. You know, there used to be a fight between what they call the Lincoln Republicans and the other ones, whatever mm-hmm. the other ones were, the reactionary conservatives. And, of course, he was always fighting, locally in politics. He was, he never run for office himself, but he was very active. There was never a political meeting of the Republican Party either, locally. And, well, he got, I guess, up on the state committee or something like that in the state of Ohio, but that's as far as he'd ever get. But he was sort of the thorn in the side of the reactionary. And he would always say, speaking of the unfinished war, and how society was going, that first of all, he was mad because it didn't really finish us at that time. He thought that the working people and the farmers, after subduing and whipping slavocracy down there, you know, because what he was mainly mad about was how some of the northern capitalists even supported, sabotaged the war, and even supported the South. He said what they should have done is not only got rid of the slavocracy down there, they should have also got rid of the whole damn monopoly or capitalist business up here, and the people should have run the thing. They fought for that, you see. So he called it an unfinished war on that basis. Mm-hmm. Well, now, but he always said the other thing, speaking about how you got confidence. He was quite an influence around among people. And that's what made him such a thorn, you know, on this side, because if he'd only been alone and unable to explain to other people, and locally there, even from the town marshal on up, you know, he had a big hand in justice of peace and all of that, mm-hmm. in keeping the big guys out. And he always says that the one you've got to do, you've got to stick with your class. He would always say, bring out the impossibility of you, with the exception of a few, of getting out of that class. You're going to be there all your life. Your whole life, your whole destiny depends on what the people do about it, you see. Well, with that little understanding that I had there, then when you get out for yourself and you begin to working among people all over, you see, then you see how important this is. You see what can be done when the people get together, I mean the workers, for instance, in all of these places. And of course that builds the confidence, and the confidence is like this. You never can shake him, you see, mm-hmm. because if they can subdue the workers, well, I am subdued with them, yeah. I go down with them. In other words, putting it in short terms, my destiny, my whole living conditions, economics, or whatever you want to put in here, goes up and down just as the workers as a whole goes, you see. Of course, these put the exceptions. I mean, people come out of the working class ranks and become big business and so on and so forth. But he also had an objection to that. How did he get there? How does a person get to be a big shot? He comes out of working class. Well, usually he's somebody and in the main that's willing to put his foot right in the face of his fellow worker. While he's trying to climb the ladder, he'll kick everybody else right in the face to do it. In other words, they're people who have no principle. And one thing is very important. If you're going to be successful, and one of the weaknesses is why the progressive movement lost as a whole, is because there wasn't enough of this principle involved in there. Instead of being principle, it became opportunism. You see, you can't be an opportunist. For my part, I'll tell you, Meridell, just as sure as I'm sitting here, and the proof of it was because I could have been given, when I left Chicago, I could have been given any district as an international representative in the UE that I wanted to choose in the whole United States, with the exceptions of Minnesota. They wouldn't let me come back here. And why wouldn't they let me come back here? Because of opportunists that we had here. Now this is a thing that a lot of people don't know. I could name them, and maybe you surmise who they are. Yes, they didn't want me back in Minnesota. Personally, they fought me from the time I went into that union, as I told you, with 33 people. That's fine. They all agreed that I should go in. But the thing was, according to them, who some of them had a pretty big mouth and no guts, I rose too fast to suit them. In other words, I took the limelight off of them through the leadership of the Flower City down there. They just didn't shine like they wanted to shine anymore. Because when it comes to that, there's one thing I never back down. I've had a lot of people. When it comes to agitation, I can agitate with any of them. I can get out of the workers, and I would like to, I don't know if you'd want to listen to a thing here about what happened at the Strutware. There's a historical thing that happened there. You want me to go into it?
Sure.
Okay.
You got time?
I have. Now here, right at the same time, or before, we went over into the Machinist Union. The old leadership here, and above all, don't play this, what I'm telling you now, out in public or to too many people, because it's not for that purpose. But Roy Weir, who I think today is the best congressman I've got in the United States.
Yeah.
I think so. But Roy Weir had been business agent of the Central Labor Union here for years. He'd done, I believe, according to what he knew as far as methods and things was concerned, the very best that he could do. Three or four different times he attempted to organize the Strutware. And on each occasion they'd just get so far and bang the company, push them back down. That's all there was to it. Well, when the strike at the Flower City, and up until this time, we hadn't had time to mingle in their affairs, but there were statements in there all the time about the situation in Strutware, the difficulties they were having, the letters from Roy Weir that he was sending to the company and all that. They had fired 80 or 90 workers there. As fast as he began to get a little organization, you know, their employers was desperate, so they're not going to let any organization get in there. And right up to the time, and even after we had won the Flower City strike, they were still firing workers down. Well, it so happened this very same day when the employers had signed this agreement that I mentioned a while ago, the Mayor Latimer calls us up to come to his office. Yep. And we went up there. We went up with a committee. And as we were going into the office, who do we meet coming out but Roy Weir? I shook hands with him. Hey, Roy, how the hell are you coming with the Strutware strike? Oh, God, the name of it. He says, that's a tough one. He says, God damn it, they busted us, or about busted us. I said, what are you going to do about it? What the hell can we do? Well, I says, for Christ's sakes, Roy, didn't we just get done setting an example to you on what you can do on that score? I says, they done the same thing. They fired everybody that they could, didn't they? Look where we are today. America congratulated us, on the victory won. I won't go into all that. I'll talk about stuff. And we stand there and we talk. This is right in the mayor's office, just going into his office. And I don't know but what he's sitting there listening to it. I says, Roy, let me tell you what's wrong. And you haven't got a union down there. And you're never going to have a union. You ain't got guts. You're yellow by God from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. And the workers is suffering. They're out of a job. Well, I sent him some letters and this and that. Yeah, he had sent him some threatening letters, threatening that we're going to strike if he didn't put him back to work. Didn't set a day, didn't place any other demands, didn't do nothing. Well, he didn't like to be called yellow. Well, I says, Roy, that's just exactly what you are. There's nothing else to it. I says, for Christ's sake, you ain't... Well, he says, what the hell can I do? I've only got 30 members there. I says, Roy, in another week you won't have none. You wasted a lot of time, wasted a lot of the union's money. You done everything else, now you got nothing. He said, well, what the hell would you do about it? You're so smart. This is his words. You're so damn smart, what would you do about it? I said, I just got done telling you that there's an example. Well, I said, now you were answering your other question. You know what I'd do about it? I would send a letter or get in contact with the company, and I would tell them, number one, demand the reinstatement of all these that's been fired. On top of that, draw up a union contract to be negotiated with the company. Not just reinstating these guys. They joined a union because they want better conditions. They took a chance on this being fired. Just reinstating them don't amount to anything. You've got to have a contract. Well, he began to listen a little bit, calm down after me calling him yellow and all that, and we talked friendly again. He says, say, I got him up to the party. He says, you think you're so damn smart? He says, I'm just going to do that. He says, will you insure me? He says, by God, I told him, I says, if you call on the people, they will shut the strut fire down. Well, he says, will you insure me that you will have the people out there to shut it down if I tell them I'm going to strike them Wednesday morning? I says, put her there, Roy. Shake hands with me. I says, I'll guarantee you that it's down. By God, I'm going to do her. Don't you let me down. Don't you let me down. He was shaking, I said, Roy, we don't let them down. This, as I say, has never been made before. Never told anybody about it. There were certain people who knew about it, even the union leaders. Bergstrom knew it. I told him, well, let's just keep still after all the strikes on. Roy is the main leader of it. And he did do what we told him to. Well, Wednesday morning came. Roy was there. And I'll tell you, when 800 workers showed up around Strutware that morning, that guy was just aghast. He just didn't know where he was. When he seen those people up there and they blocked any scabs from getting in, there was a few that got in because word got out, and they went out at 2 o'clock in the morning. And they brought a bunch of kids in the plant, mostly kids. And they were in there, but nobody else got in after the picket line got there. The picket line didn't get there till about 7, and they had a couple hundred in before that, see? And from then on, nothing moved as far as getting anybody through there. There was no disturbance, just a good solid picket line around it. And then the question came up. This all happened in one day. Why? They said, well, by God, the workers decided, well, there's one thing about it. they'll never get no damn food in there for them to eat. We'll starve them out. And the crowd got bigger all day long. And so it got pretty hot, you know. After all, this ordinance there, they could only keep them in the plant so long, they had to take them out, you know. And Governor Olson had made a statement that there would never be any more bloodshed in the strike. That he would take over, I mean, before this happened. That the first gun cracked, well, he's going to take it. And sure enough, down there somebody, some cop shot at somebody. I think he shot over his head. But this was quite a ways away from there, but it was enough anyhow. Governor Olson sent the National Guards over. The main thing was to get these kids out of this plant that didn't have nothing to eat. They hadn't had any dinner. They came in there at 2 o'clock in the morning. Company was going to give them all this stuff. They couldn't get a bite of food in the damn place, you know. And they were hungry. And of course, Roy got the word from the governor that he's sending the National Guards over to take them out. And the governor requested that he would be assured Weir and the Union that the plant would not open up until all danger of any bloodshed is removed, and that they would take these kids out of there, do you see? Roy came to me. Well, how in the hell? By that time, I suppose it had grown to 3,000 people or so, because it was in the paper that the strikers or the pickets wouldn't let them out. They were going to starve them in there. They didn't have nothing to eat and so on and so forth. And of course, that only brings more people, you see. And they wanted to be there for the showdown. The result was thousands and thousands of people. It was just a mass of people all around the place. Well, Roy was worried. He was really worried. How in the hell? Because if the National Guards, I told him, I said, first of all, you tell the governor now, don't just rush the National Guards in there. Because the workers in town remember what the National Guards done in the truck driver's strike when they couldn't get any way to fight back after they'd been shot. You just rush them in without these workers knowing what's going to happen. They're going to fight National Guards or anybody else that comes. I said, it's proven all over the country. They did it in numbers of places like in Toledo, Ohio, and all those places, you know. Well, I said, I know it. Well, I said, you get assurance in writing from the governor that he's going to close the plant down until this thing is settled, that there'll be no more shooting, no more bloodshed. By God, he got it. He got the loader, he got it back in just a little while. I don't know, I think the governor was pretty close because he got a written statement. But what do you think? This here shows you confidence in the workers and lack of confidence in the workers. As long as Roy Weir had been secretary and in the labor movement in Minneapolis, he didn't have the slightest idea what he could do with that. He called it a mob. I criticized him for it. No, this isn't a mob. These are workers who come here to fight your battle for you. They're all good people. They're civilized. Well, what are we going to do now when the National Guard comes in to let the kids out? Well, first of all, the National Guard doesn't even have to come in, Roy, to let the kids out of there. All you have to do is get up and assure the people that the only thing we want to do is to let them kids out of that place without any harm to anybody. We let them out and we have assurance that the plant is going to be closed down. And I says, they'll listen to you. And we'll say now when they come, when they're ready, we'll give the orders, tell them to bring them out, we'll part our lines and form a nice place for them to walk down through without anybody harming anybody. God, it can't be done. It can't be done. The way these people are fired up here, it just can't be done. I said, of course it can be done, Roy. He says, I can't do it. He says, will you do it for me? And if anybody will remember, they'll remember that I made the speech from the top of the car. I says to him, just whispering in his ear, I says, see, Roy, you haven't got confidence in the workers. You haven't got any confidence in the workers. That's the trouble. And I got up with all those thousands of people, and we had the loudspeakers there. I read the telegram, and I said, this is exactly what we want to do now. And we, of course, we had picket captains there. And instead of becoming the militant picket captains to see that no scab come in, it became their duty to see that this opening was made through there where these people could be taken through without any harm done to them. And I requested that they do it, and that place just opened up. It just backed up just like two waves in the sea, don't you know? They came through. Sure, there was cat calls. There was scabs and this and that. I recommended for them not to even do it. And when they did do it, I stood on top of the car. I said, "Now, don't do this. Remember, these are poor kids, probably attempting to support a mother and a father someplace, that they picked up at 2 o'clock last night and brought in here." And that crowd got just as calm as could be. Well, they took them out, but there was one thing Roy done that day. You know, he's been a friend of mine for a long time. As long as somebody else doesn't see him talking to me, don't you know? Mm-hmm. Because I'm supposed to be red, and Roy just doesn't like to have people, but this is, I say, don't ever play this in public. I'm just the people. And I've never seen him any place, you know, but Abel, he says, "Do you know, I never seen a guy like you." He says, "One minute you've got them so damn fired up that they'll walk through hell." And he says, "The next minute," he says, "they're just as calm as they can be." I says, "Roy, these people are civilized. You're not dealing with people that don't know what they're doing. All you have to do is explain to them honestly and openly." And that time, the only provocateuring we had was again by the Trotskyites. Yeah. They were the ones who caused the shooting. Well, maybe in a way it was good. I mean, because what? That's the first strike that ever took place in the state of Minnesota, and it, cold weather was coming on, you'll remember. And it was a real cold winter. The National Guards had done the picketing. They had a tent set up at each corner down there. The strike headquarters was over across the street. And when the workers went back, they went back with not all of their demands, but they went back with much better conditions. All of the workers were reinstated and paid for the time they were off.